This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's not every presidency that's dubbed a revolution while it's in progress, and not every president that begets an ism to describe his policies. But people did speak of the Reagan Revolution and Reaganism, even Reaganomics, in the 1980s. In tone and in substance, at home and abroad, Ronald Reagan changed the country's direction in several ways. And here to talk about what his presidency meant for the U.S. then and now are our guest political observers, columnists David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post, as well as Georgetown University. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
When we think of Ronald Reagan, we think of him certainly appealing to Americans' optimism and to their desire for less government and lower taxes. This is from August 1981, when he was trying to get his tax cut passed.
I ask you now to put aside any feelings of frustration or helplessness about our political institutions and join me in this dramatic but responsible plan to reduce the enormous burden of federal taxation on you and your family. During recent months, many of you have asked, what can you do to help make America strong again? I urge you again to contact your senators and congressmen. Tell them of your support for this bipartisan proposal. Tell them you believe this is an unequaled opportunity to help return America to prosperity and make government again the servant of the people.
Ultimately, taxes were cut. And I wonder what your thoughts are. Was Reaganism a shifting of the plates that underlie our politics, or might it be, as Arthur Schlesinger suggests in Newsweek, a transient episode in the stream of American history? David Brooks, you first.
I think absolutely a transformation. Among other things, a transformation in the Republican Party. Remember, this was a guy who ran against a sitting Republican president in 1976. And we heard a snippet of it just in that speech. You know, his optimism wasn't just brain chemistry. It was tied to a deep creed that was deeply optimistic that America had a mission in the world and that it would triumph and create a sort of a global empire of liberty. And when he talked about even things like tax policy, he always talked about it in nationalistic and moral terms. And so he thought America was going to lead the world to this great golden age. And I think that was the underlying theme of his optimism. And one of the reasons, you know, he wanted to unleash all this creativity, the economic entrepreneurialism and growth. It was a moral cause more than just giving people back their money.
E.J. Dionne?
Well, I think that Reaganism was in many ways transient, although I think the change in the Republican Party, pushing it to the right, making it a conservative party, is a real transformation in our politics. It's worth remembering that on his tax cut, almost as soon as it was passed, at the urging of Senator Bob Dole, Reagan backed away from it and actually pushed a tax increase through. And then there was another tax increase under George Bush and another under Bill Clinton because the deficits just became so big despite Reagan's promises. I think the optimism and the buoyancy we remember fondly now because we were in such a divisive sort of politics. But this idea that government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem, even conservatives have backed away from that. I recently ran across writings from two very smart conservatives who criticized a foolish and politically suicidal contempt for the American state. How can Americans love their nation if they hate its government? Those were wise words written by David Brooks and Bill Kristol. Now, I think that reflects a shift on the conservative side of the argument.
David, I'll give you the opportunity to recant if you want to right now.
Well, I'm not going to recant. I think, you know, Republicans have never been actually good at following through on their promise to cut government. I think Reagan's transformation, though, really was in America's sense of itself and the Republican Party's sense of where Americans stood. You forget what conservatives were like before Reagan. Sort of a dour group who thought they were on the losing side of history, that communism was going to triumph. Reagan couldn't imagine that. And, you know, when he talked about his policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, it was very simply said, we win, they lose.
Yeah.
And that was a culmination. That was a culminating psychology.
Ronald Reagan reversed bipartisan Cold War policies that had evolved over decades, reduce arms, avoid risk, manage the conflict down to some mutually respectful coexistence with the Soviet Union. He said, no, win the Cold War. And he challenged the Soviet Union to match U.S. military technology in ways that would have bankrupted Moscow. This is, for example, the Strategic Defense Initiative he announced in March of 1983.
What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack? That we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies. I call upon the scientific community in our country, those who gave us nuclear weapons, to turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace. to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete.
E.J. Dionne, I want to hear your judgment of if not SDI alone, President Reagan's approach to the Cold War. Even if you give him credit for policies that, along with Mikhail Gorbachev's policies, put an end to the Soviet Union, it's 20 years later, there's still no strategic defense initiative, and scientists have not done all those things that he was urging them to do.
Right. I don't think the Strategic Defense Initiative is an important legacy of Ronald Reagan. I do think he did help end the Cold War in three ways. One, I think the victory in getting the Ural missiles in place in Europe actually did rob the Soviet Union of a political card that it hoped to play. Once Europe showed solidarity, I think a lot of people in the Soviet Union, in the Soviet leadership, started rethinking things. The arms buildup may have had something to do with it, although the arms buildup began under Jimmy Carter. I think what was critical is the flexibility Ronald Reagan showed, not a word we associate with him much. Mm-hmm. When Gorbachev came along, Reagan was one of the first people, so was Margaret Thatcher, to understand that Gorbachev actually was a reformer. And I think by embracing Gorbachev, a Cold Warrior showed that he believed the Soviet Union could change, and I think Reagan did hasten its collapse by doing that.
David Brooks?
Well, first, we heard in that segment his incredible faith in the future of this technology, mm-hmm. Which is a part of his legacy. A Russian once told me when I was over there that the SDI was the most successful weapons program. It worked, and it didn't even have to be deployed, because it did crush Soviet confidence. Edward Shevardnadze has said as much, that they knew they couldn't compete with that, and they realized they had to change. Now, it's true practically it hasn't actually panned out so far. Nonetheless, I think by being aggressive and by continually putting on the pressure and crushing psychologically the Soviets in their sense they could compete, you know, it did work.
Ronald Reagan also broke with his predecessors on many domestic policies. He was an avowed critic of welfare and environmental programs that previous Republican presidents, the most immediate ones, Presidents Nixon and Ford, had actually agreed with. And in dealing with labor, he did something that was completely unexpected. This was back in 1981 when the air traffic controllers went on strike, and President Reagan read them the letter of the law.
Let me read the solemn oath taken by each of these employees. I am not participating in any strike against the government of the United States or any agency thereof. It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And they were terminated. And we might add that Ronald Reagan was the only president who had been president of a labor union, the Screen Actors Guild. A significant moment in Reagan's presidency, David Brooks?
Yeah, I think so. As a demonstration of leadership, PATCO, of course, had endorsed Reagan. Reagan had offered them, I think, an 11% raise, and they demanded something much, much higher. He was sort of incensed that they would go against their own word, their own affidavit they'd signed not to strike. And mostly it was a sign the president was going to take this firm and tough action, and turned out to be quite popular. But it was a part of his legacy, which is the strengthening of the presidency, an office which had been diminishing since Watergate, obviously, and now it goes from strength to strength.
And weakening labor at the same time, EJ?
Right, and I think that was one of its objectives, and I think that's had some unfortunate effects. If you look at the economic growth in the 1980s, it was very disproportionately toward the very well-off, unlike the economic growth in the 90s, which was, especially in the late 90s, which was much better distributed. And I think that goes to a shift, if you will, in the power of different classes in the country during the Reagan administration. I think the old labor movement was hurt, and you mentioned correctly Reagan's cuts in social programs. Overall, low-income programs bore nearly one-third of all the cuts made under Reagan in the federal government, even though they constituted less than one-tenth of the budget. So there clearly was a tilt, and I think that's a part of the Reagan legacy that at least some of us wish weren't there.
Though the fact is the poverty rates rose through the 70s and plateaued in the 80s, so they did halt the decline in all sorts of measures of well-being.
But you had declines in the share of income, and in many of those years, real income at the bottom end of the economy. I think that's something we're going to be debating between the 80s and the 90s for a long time.
I want to hear what both of you make of Ronald Reagan's style in the presidency. I think from JFK through Jimmy Carter, there certainly was, perhaps it was an anti-Eisenhower effect of the president always being extremely busy, working very hard, being involved in everything, super energetic. And then we had a rather older man become president, enjoy his vacations very seriously, and seemed to enjoy taking a nap and relaxing all the time. It was a change in an image of what the president did. EJ, do you remember that transition?
I do indeed. I think that anybody who says that busy work is a bad thing should deserve some credit, and that some of the activities of that presidents engage in just to look busy are not to be welcomed. There is the flip side, and also just his general mood. I think whatever your politics, the mood that Ronald Reagan created, I think everybody respected. The flip side of that was a certain looseness in his talk. I mean, mm-hmm. He said things like the Russian language has no word for freedom. Well, there is a Russian word for freedom, svoboda, and there are a lot of those small things where you wish Ronald Reagan had paid a little more attention to a few more details, though politically, obviously, it didn't hurt him very much.
David?
Yeah, I'm sort of struck by the incredible difference in leadership styles that have emerged since Reagan between the two parties. Reagan really did lay down the Republican leadership style, which is to be a simple, straight-talking man of faith. And the Democratic style, the Democrats tend to emphasize nuance and complexity and the need to have a more supple understanding of the world and have a broader culture and more education, perhaps. And we really do have an incredible rivalry in leadership styles. And I think Reagan really laid that out. You can even measure it today if you cover a Bush event and then a Kerry event and measure the length of the sentences of the two candidates. Two different ways of talking, two different ways of leading.
Although Reagan was very elegant in his use of language. I mean, he was very careful when he wasn't making mistakes, when he was giving formal speeches. He really did care about how speeches sounded. There was something, I think his sentences were certainly longer than the ones used by the current president.
Although off the top of his head, when he spoke, when he improvised in a news conference, he could relate the history of the Middle East in ways that were unrecognizable to people who had studied
his staff.
Yes.
Still have nightmares about that.
Of what the president could say when he was off on his own.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Very briefly from both of you, very, very quickly, this is kind of one-word answer. How do you think this president's going to be remembered? Do you think he's going to go down as one of the greats, near greats, not-so-good failed presidency? David Brooks?
I think Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan are the three pivot points in the American presidency in the 20th century, so I put them up at the top.
EJ?
I'd put him near great because he clearly achieved major changes in the direction of the country, but I only say near great because I think there were some real problems, the Iran-Contra situation, the disaster in Lebanon, the deficits. So I think he did achieve a great deal of change, but there will still be doubts about him among historians.
Well, thanks to both of you for talking with us today about the late Ronald Reagan. E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Georgetown University, and David Brooks of The New York Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.